This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Jeb Bush officially joins the U.S. Republican presidential contest. An international conference focuses on fighting radicalization on the Internet.
There are no simple solutions. You know, these people are facing a huge propaganda machinery and campaign. And we are at the heart of a system for brainwashing young people.
We'll take you to a store that sells a combination of items unlike any other. And we'll also hear about a most unusual musician who wants to turn his work into lighting up parts of Africa. These stories are more just ahead. I'm Ray Kugel. Former Florida Governor Jeb Bush is officially in the running for the 2016 U.S. Republican Party presidential nomination. He is the 11th Republican in the race, with more candidates likely in the coming weeks. The announcement came Monday in Miami, Florida. VOA's Jim Stevenson talked with reporter Carolyn Pursuti about the newest addition to the race for president.
Jeb Bush is the new man, the former Florida governor. He served 8 years as Florida governor, and now he says he wants to be president. He would be the third Bush as president.
Wow, and that sets up a potential Bush-Clinton campaign. We've seen this before.
And that's what some pundits are saying. Do we want to have history repeat itself? And incidentally, they are throwing stones at each other that same way. Bush today said, we need to fix America, but not by someone who has already had that chance, inferring that Hillary Clinton, as Secretary of State under President Obama, did have that chance. We need somebody new. But then talking to pundits, some say that a third Bush is one too many, and some say a second Clinton is one too many. So we're left with those types of choices. Will that mean that somebody else comes to the forefront? Maybe they negate each other's candidacy. Who knows?
Interesting. Now, apparently a clear strategy has already come out front as to the type of voter that Bush is going after.
Absolutely. Here we thought that he was going to distance himself in his announcement from his father and his brother, who served terms in the White House. But instead, he's setting himself up to be the Hispanic candidate. He's truly playing toward the Hispanic voters. He started out with three singers who sang in Spanish, and they are the Chirino singers. They are the three daughters of a very famous Cuban singer, Willie Chirino. Also, he had speakers before he announced his candidacy come to the stage, and they spoke in Spanish. He spoke in Spanish. Of course, he's married to Columbo Bush, and he met her in Mexico, so learned to speak fluent Spanish because of his wife. They've been married for years. She was his only girlfriend. They're the only girlfriend he's ever known.
Wow. And perhaps first lady one day. We'll have to see. Interesting that his logo just says Jeb 2016. Now, there's some interesting conversation about that, too.
You are so right, Tim. People say, where's the last name? Where's the Bush name? Does that mean he's trying to set himself apart from his brother and his father? It just has Jeb in bold red letters with an exclamation mark. And the question then is, does that mean that he is saying, I'm definitely conservative with that exclamation mark? And then underneath, in navy blue, 2016.
Always fun to watch politics, especially when politicians are trying to position themselves and distance themselves and bring themselves closer. And it's a very interesting tightrope that Jeb Bush is walking between history and trying to define his own image.
Absolutely. But you can also say the same about Hillary.
Mm-hmm.
Her logo is just an H with an arrow. So where's the
pointing
Clinton
to
there?
The right?
Exactly. Good point.
VOA reporter Carolyn Pursuti talking with Jim Stevenson. Recent national political opinion surveys show Jeb Bush, who is 62 years old, virtually deadlocked with two other candidates, Florida Senator Marco Rubio, who joined the contest earlier, and Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker, who has yet to officially announce. Other Republicans are not far behind in the pre-election polling. Michael Lippin joins us now for a look at how the social media world is reacting to Jeb Bush's announcement. Michael?
Thanks, Ray. Yes, Jeb Bush already is getting a boost to his social media following thanks to that long-awaited campaign kickoff. His Twitter account, at Jeb Bush, was at 197,000 followers a few hours before the event, and now it's surpassed 200,000. On Facebook, it's a different story. He had 186,000 followers when I last checked. That's way behind one of his main rivals for the Republican nomination, his fellow Floridian U.S. Senator Marco Rubio. Rubio has 879,000 Facebook followers and 747,000 Twitter fans. Now, you could expect Rubio to have a bigger social media presence, considering that he is a serving U.S. senator and that he has already been in the presidential race for 2 months, whereas Bush hasn't been in office for 8 years, and he's relatively little known outside of Florida, where he served as a state governor. The two Floridians did actually engage in some friendly banter on Twitter earlier Monday. Rubio used his Twitter account to wish the new candidate well, saying, "My friend Jeb Bush is a passionate advocate for what he believes, and I welcome him to the race." Bush, who like Rubio is from Miami, had a pretty gracious response to that, tweeting, "Thanks, Marco. Glad I can do it in our hometown. See you out there." Whether they will still be as pleasant as that to each other as the going gets tough in this presidential campaign, we'll have to see.
So, how much attention is Jeb Bush getting today in the Twitter world?
Easily the most attention that he's had in the past month. Analytics website Topsy shows that his name has been tweeted about 50,000 times in the last 24 hours. Some of the most common hashtags that people have been using to talk about Jeb Bush on Twitter include the hashtag Jeb Bush, that's all one word, and also hashtag Jeb2016, his official campaign name. But I've also seen some other Bush-related hashtags get attention today. One of them Bush won't necessarily like, and that's the hashtag No More Bushes. It's been used about 20,000 times in the past day, and it's been a popular way for people who don't like Bush to point out his relation to the two other recent U.S. presidents, of course, his father George H.W. Bush and brother George W. Bush. Another hashtag that also started getting used more frequently today is a kind of a reaction to No More Bushes. Perhaps inevitably, this one is called No More Clintons. It's a little reminder that there is another family out there, the Clintons, that some people think shouldn't make it back to the White House. And I've actually seen some people use both hashtags in the same tweet. Ray?
Thanks, Michael. You can follow him on Twitter. His handle is at Michael_Lipin. That's LIPIN. You're listening to International Edition on The Voice of America.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, the host for Jazz America, where each week we give you the best of jazz past and present and conversation with the music makers. You can hear the program online at voanews.com and on the air on VOA each Saturday and Sunday at 13 hours Universal Time. Join me for Jazz America and help me celebrate the greatness of a century of jazz. Listen at 13 hours Universal Time, Saturdays and Sundays, on voanews.com and The Voice of America.
United Nations-led peace talks between warring Yemeni factions began in Switzerland Monday. Secretary General Ban Ki-moon called for pro-government forces and rebels to observe a humanitarian ceasefire of at least 2 weeks during the Muslim holy month of Ramadan. VOA Susan Yaki spoke by telephone with correspondent Heather Murdoch at our Middle East Bureau in Cairo about the situation in Yemen.
What can you tell us about what the UN official had to say?
Well, he's asking for a ceasefire, and that has in the past worked. There was a week-long ceasefire that did allow some humanitarian aid that was more or less both sides complied with. At this point, though, they're also starting peace talks. So they're hoping that if things calm down a little bit, it might be possible that the peace talks will be more successful. But so far, it's not looking so good.
Well, how are those talks proceeding? Are the two sides meeting and that sort of thing?
Well, the main problem is that Houthis, the rebel group, actually does control much or most of Yemen. They haven't arrived yet. People in Yemen have been telling me for the past couple of weeks that they were hopeful these talks would be much different from the other talks because the other talks never included the Houthis. And the Houthis have had, now since March 26, a 10-country coalition pounding them with missiles, and they're still stronger than they were before. So without them in the game, it's really hard to believe that peace talks mean anything.
Perhaps you could further describe for us the situation that's going on in Yemen.
Yemen has a population of 22 to 24 million people, I think, and the UN says that 20 million people are in desperate need of humanitarian aid. I talked to people in Yemen say that there is almost no fuel to get anywhere, so even if there is food or water, it can't get to the people who need it the most. Even before this war began, before the Arab Spring, Yemen was having a water crisis and was set to be the country with the first capital to run out of groundwater in the world. There's also a desperate need for medical supplies. People say that there's not nearly enough medical supplies. Yemen's healthcare system was a disaster before the war, so now people are basically without any.
VOA's Heather Murnock in Cairo. The fight against the so-called Islamic State group and other extremist organizations is not just taking place on the ground. It is also going on in cyberspace. The web war is alive and well. But for the next 2 days, experts, politicians, and youths from around the world are in Paris to talk strategy. UNESCO, the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, will host the meeting. Lisa Bryant has details.
The challenge, fighting radicalization and extremism on the internet. The response, that's not so easy, says conference organizer Boyan Radoykov.
What we can say right now is that this will be a very long-term problem to deal with. We are facing a problem that we will have to tackle for the next 20 years.
Many countries are witnessing this problem firsthand. Radical websites are mushrooming on the web, along with sites that offer young people easy pointers on how to tap them.
There are no simple solutions. You know, these people are facing a huge propaganda machinery and campaign. And we are at the heart of a system for brainwashing young people.
The UNESCO conference will look at different responses to internet radicalization around the world and also the downsides, like concerns over threats to free expression. The speakers include young people from Jordan, Syria, Libya, and Tunisia who will discuss their experiences. The battle against extremism is taking place inside and outside cyberspace. Some of the answers are coming from young people returning from jihad.
By saying, look, this is why I went to do the jihad and to meet these people, and this is why I came back. And this is sometimes even stronger than any website and any explanation that you may give when you hear from the heart of the people who lived through it.
Ultimately, Radoykov believes the fight against extremism on the net will be won. At the end, he says, reason always wins. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
Still to come, a visit to a unique store filled with exotic plants and comic books. A new report finds countries expecting the biggest boost in population in the coming years are the ones that are the least equipped to handle it. The report by the Population Institute identifies and ranks the 20 countries facing the greatest demographic challenges with respect to hunger, poverty, water scarcity, environmental degradation, and political instability. South Sudan topped the report's list of the 20 most demographically vulnerable countries. It was rated as severely vulnerable in the areas of hunger, poverty, and instability. Somalia, second on the list, was ranked high for hunger and environment and severe for poverty and instability. Other countries in the top 10 included Niger, Burundi, Eritrea, Chad, Democratic Republic of Congo, Afghanistan, Yemen, and Sudan.
This is Greenbeat for a healthier planet.
Algae, otherwise known as pond scum, may not be the scourge its name suggests.
Like other plants, the green, slimy stuff converts sunlight into energy, some of it in the form of natural oils that researchers hope will one day turn into a viable alternative fuel source. That's a priority for world leaders, including President Obama.
All the G7 countries have now put forward our post-2020 targets for reducing carbon emissions.
Algae may be one of the ways to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. The University of Maryland's Patrick Kanga set up an algae farm outside Washington, originally to study farm water runoff.
We produce a lot of algae, and in the past, there was no real purpose that we could use that algae for, and now we're starting to see markets emerge, and it's very exciting.
The U.S. Department of Energy has committed millions of dollars in research funding for biofuels, including algae production. For VOA's Green Beat, I'm Rebecca Ward.
We all suffer from sore throats and ear infections from time to time. A common antibiotic used for treatment may be a potent weapon against superbugs infections caused by bacteria that are resistant to most other drugs. Researchers made the discovery when they took a new approach to testing azithromycin. Here's VOA's Jessica Berman.
The common antibiotic azithromycin, sold commercially as Zithromax Z-Pak, has not gotten much attention as an agent that could be used to kill superbugs. In traditional laboratory tests against three drug-resistant bacteria, it did not perform well. But under different conditions, azithromycin was highly effective against three difficult-to-treat pathogens. Instead of doing the testing in a standard laboratory culture, scientists tested Z-Paks in a culture that was more like the human body and contained a lot of human natural bacteria fighting factors. The results were surprising. Vincent Nizé is a professor of pediatrics and pharmacology at the University of California, San Diego.
And this activity was so potent that we could see that azithromycin was able to cure some of these infections in a mouse model of the drug-resistant pathogen.
Nizé's group found that azithromycin in this human culture medium zapped three superbugs. Superbugs tend to infect debilitated hospital patients with weakened immune systems and are often lethal because no antibiotics are effective against the pathogens. This study is important because it suggests some antibiotics that have been largely ignored in the treatment of serious infections could in fact save lives.
If you are seeing a percentage of treatment failures with current antibiotic therapy, then it is important to step back and ask, have we studied all the antibiotics in the richest context that could yield the best treatment?
While he says more research is needed, Nizé says it's possible physicians might want to try drugs like azithromycin, which have a proven safety record, in their sickest patients. Results of the study by Victor Nizé and colleagues are published in the journal eBiomedicine. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
What is it like to study in the United States, and what do you have to do to get here? The Student Union is VOA's blog that follows students from all over the world as they face challenges and opportunities of studying at American universities. Log on at blogs.voanews.com/student-union.
There is a one-of-a-kind shop in Alexandria, Virginia that's like nothing you will ever see. Since it opened 40 years ago, the stores remain virtually the same. You can find an odd assortment of older stuff from comic books to trading cards. The owner does not use the modern technology found in most American stores. VOA's Deborah Block paid a visit to this most unusual place.
When 68-year-old Dennis Webb was a boy, he liked to grow plants and enjoyed reading comic books. So when he got older, he combined all his hobbies into a one-of-a-kind store.
I'm just trying to have a good, steady income and do things that I enjoy doing, you know, working with people that like some of the same things I like.
His shop is called The Exotic Plantarium and Card and Comic Collectorama. Along with Venus flytraps that eat insects, the store is packed with an eclectic mix of items, records, old books and magazines, and action figures in their original packaging. He's even got newspaper clippings of famous people's obituaries. Nothing is new, even his phone and the refrigerator where he keeps his lunch. Webb doesn't own a cell phone.
I don't like the idea of walking around with a cell phone and being on call all the time.
He has no interest in selling his products over the internet, even though he might make more money. Nothing here costs more than $100.
I like people coming in the store to buy things instead of, you know, to talk with them. And seems to me people would get more out of it if they came in and looked around and they'd find other things maybe of interest to them that they'd never know about.
Marty Belkowitz came in to browse out of curiosity.
He's got an enormous collection and a lot of the things that I remember from my childhood, which was always fun.
Webb's biggest collection is several thousand comic books. There are rare editions on the wall, some going back to the 1940s.
I get a lot of my comics from other people that come by, and maybe they're moving, they're not interested in collecting them. Maybe they inherited them from somebody and they didn't really want them.
Most are jammed into old cardboard boxes, carefully sorted by the era and type of comic book. Collector David Kingwood is searching for Superman comic books from his childhood.
It's been around so long since, what's the late 30s? People have grown up with them.
Kingwood finds a few he wants, and Webb writes up the sales slip. He doesn't use a computer. He says they take too much of his time. The store also boasts an extensive collection of trading cards. This card has a background with real gold. Jaden Tumiwa lives nearby and buys sports cards to trade with friends.
The older, the more valuable they are, and he's got some pretty good prices, so I come in here often.
The collectorama seems out of place now in a neighborhood that has become more upscale in recent years. But Webb says he is content with the aging store and wouldn't change a thing. Deborah Block, VOA News, Alexandria, Virginia.
A Senegalese-American musician hopes he can make his fans see the light, literally. Here's David Byrd and Ray McDonald together in the studio to explain what's going on.
You might know Senegalese-American musician and producer Akon for his song Beautiful, but you didn't know that he is part of a group that wants to bring electric power to 600 million people in Africa. To find out more, Ray McDonald joins me in the studio. Ray, this is a huge undertaking for a pop star, a musician.
Yeah, it is, and it just riveted my attention when I first read about it a couple weeks ago. Now, Akon last released an album in 2008, but he has been busy. He's working on something he calls Lighting Africa. Now, it's a two-year-old project with a billion-dollar credit line. He's working with two partners, and he hopes to provide 600 million Africans with energy from the sun.
Now, its first project, as I understand, is the launch of a solar academy in Mali to train people to work with this initiative?
The Solar Academy in Bamako, Mali is slated to begin this North American summer. And on Wednesday, Akon told a UN news conference that Lighting Africa has now spread to 14 countries in Saharan and sub-Saharan Africa. So he is really working hard to get this project off the ground.
And providing light to these people or energy to these people not only benefits them by allowing them to have electricity, but also kids can study at home and people can work later. It helps them economically too, right?
Well, Akon says one of the big objectives of Lighting Africa is to take advantage of the continent's human capital. Many parts of Africa get more than 300 days of sun a year, and 70% of the continent's population is under 35. Akon wants to put them to work in building this solar infrastructure and maintaining it.
All right, that's VOA's Ray McDonald. We'd love to hear your opinion on this. You can log on to our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/Voice of America. If you're on Twitter, you can also hit up Ray McDonald at VOA_music, or Ray, your Twitter handle for your personal account?
Ray on the hits.
You can also listen for Ray on VOA 1 if you like to listen to music, and you can also hear him do the top 20 and the top 5 countdowns every week.
When I see you, I run out of words to say. Girl, make you stay.
that's it for this edition of International Edition. You can get more news and information on our website at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington. Enjoy the day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The question is not whether the Earth's climate is changing, but how are we going to adjust to the effects of climate change? Climate change poses a threat to every country on Earth, and we all need to do what we can to take advantage of the small window of opportunity we still have to stave off its worst, most disastrous impacts, wrote Secretary of State John Kerry in a recent statement. But even as we take unprecedented steps to mitigate the climate threat, we also have to ensure our communities are prepared for the impacts we know are headed our way. Located at the end of the Ganges and Brahmaputra drainage basins, and with much of its area comprised of low-lying coastal plains, Bangladesh has a long history of disastrous flooding. At about 1,000 people per square kilometer, it has the world's highest population density per square kilometer. Moreover, 80% of the country's population depends on agriculture as a source of income. All of these factors combine to make Bangladesh one of the most vulnerable to the impacts of climate change. This is expected to worsen as climate change exacerbates extreme weather events, such as monsoon rains and cyclones, and as sea levels rise with the melting of the ice caps. Some experts estimate that Bangladesh could lose 2 to 3% of GDP growth due to the effects of climate change. Bangladesh must prepare for the changes, but as a developing country with about half of its population living in poverty, it is finding the going difficult. That is why Bangladesh is one of the three countries, along with Colombia and Ethiopia, targeted for climate readiness assistance in the first phase of President Barack Obama's new Climate Services for Resilient Development initiative. This international public-private partnership will work with developing nations to help them boost their own climate resilience by providing them with science relevant to their situation, information, useful tools, and training. The initiative will concentrate on adaptation to changing conditions. And as the program matures, more countries will be invited to participate. When it comes to confronting climate change, no country should be forced to go it alone, because no country can possibly address this threat alone, said Secretary of State Kerry. It will require all of us, every country around the world, doing what it can to contribute to the solution.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.